Welcome to Season 5 of the Bite Science Podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Sullivan. In this series, we are further expanding our knowledge by speaking to experts in the fields of physiology, psychology, nutrition, strength and conditioning, and mindset training. We'll be speaking to the coaches and practitioners who do this every day, and to the researchers and academics who are at the forefront of the latest science. Today, our guest is Mike Angove. Lightning Mike Angove is a former world champion kickboxer and professional boxer. He is New Zealand's leading combat sports analyst and commentator, and is often found in the commentary box for many of New Zealand's major events. Mike is also one of the coaches at world-renowned City Kickboxing, home of UFC middleweight champ Israel Adesanya, UFC featherweight champ Alexander Volkanovski, Dan Hooker, Brad Riddell, Kai Kara France, Shane Young, and a stack of contenders on the rise. I've gotten Mike on the podcast to chat about two things: the coaching systems at City Kickboxing, and to talk about the rich history of combat sports across Australia and New Zealand, to give some context of how this history has shaped one of the best gyms in modern combat sports. This is a great episode for all combat sports enthusiasts, so let's get to it. All right, green light means we are live, so back for another episode of the Fight Science Podcast. Now, today is going to be a bit of a pivot from what we normally talk about, the nerdy talk and everything else, and a pivot for the best way possible, because we are joined by Coach Mike Angove, Lightning Mike. He is one of City Kickboxing's coaches, one of the most pivotal parts of their team, I would even say. Lightning Mike, thanks for coming on, mate.
Yeah, I think I'm more of a pivot than a pivotal part. looks good to be on. We got a lot going on, obviously, with 10 of us going over, the four guys fighting plus another couple looking at the contender series. So it's a very, very busy time for us.
Yeah, and the reason I got Mike on for this is because I want to kind of talk about and give everyone a bit of context, because I think City Kickboxing, where they are right now, there's so much media hype around it, and for good reason. In my belief, it's the best MMA gym in the world, but that comes from years and years and years and years of rich history of combat sports in New Zealand. And I only really have first heard the story when Mike spoke about it elsewhere. And I thought, wow, the world needs to hear the other part of this story. But before we get into all that, Mike, obviously the boys are getting ready for this upcoming card, and New Zealand's been going through COVID. Tell us about that. How have you guys been managing that and getting through that? How's the boys been making it work?
Well, pretty restrictive, particularly went into level 3 lockdown, which essentially means you're confined to your home or your immediate bubble. So what we did was we had the boys ship in all their bedding, all their food into the gym. The gym was closed, and that effectively became the training bubble for that 2-week period. And it's kind of like going back to boarding school, or a little bit of this is Sparta woven in there, and it really is just eat, train, sleep, repeat, and there's no other distractions externally apart from Bo Rawiri's cooking, and a little bit of barbecue outside. The boys brought in a barbecue, and they had a butcher deliver meat. But other than that, it was pretty much full on training. Eugene developed his karaoke skills in the morning. If you want to check into a few of the boys' feeds, you'll see Eugene's very unique ability to raise people up at about 7 a.m. in the morning. And it was good for the team. It gets a whole team vibe going, and it's making the best of a difficult situation with COVID. You know, you only had 10 in the bubble that you were allowed there. So that meant, you know, perhaps we didn't quite have the two or three additional sparring partners we might have wanted, but still, it's, the guys come out of there in really, really good nick, fit and focused, and it's just continued on from there.
Yeah, it's crazy. And it's a testament to just how high level and top quality of a team they are. I remember when Brad told me that they were going in, I remember thinking, wow, like, man, they're all great guys, but they're all very different personalities. And I was thinking, you know, rocking up for training is one thing, but then living within each other's pockets. And I was thinking, how's this going to go? And I know poor old Kai was a bit skeptical about it, but From all reports, at least what they told me, it seemed to go really well. But what did you hear, Mike? Did anything go bad or what?
Oh, mate, what goes on tour stays on tour. but look, you know, Kai actually got the executive suite. The smallest man in the building got the biggest room with the best view. And Kai bought in his own, what looked like a queen-size mattress, and everything was in its place, as you'd expect with Kai. Most of the boys just locked down in the marae. Bloods, you know, he actually really enjoyed it, because basically all he had to do was train, eat and sleep, and that suited him just fine. You know, Izzy's obviously there, he was stuck in his corner. Carlos was meditating on a mountain every second day. You know, Bo Rauri bought pretty much his whole house. So we had, what do you call it? You had a canopy outside, you had a barbecue set up, you had barriers in place so people couldn't just, you know, wander in. So yeah, all in all, look, it was a pretty good experience. They gelled together well. Brad Riddell was still an angry little fucker. But you know, that's no change from how he normally is. Yeah, it's just, as you say, it's a tight-knit group. It's a group that knows each other pretty well. And although it's an individual sport, you know, there's a lot of team element in getting one person into the cage or into the ring. And, you know, you really saw testament to that. And that takes good leadership as well, not just from Huge. I think he was probably the guy who went most mad over the period there. You know, if you looked at him, he showed symptoms of nervous tics and, you know, irrational ravings. But you know, the rest of the team is as well. You know, grumpy old Brad was leading from the front, you know, always sort of taking direction, making suggestions. You know, Izzy's in there doing his thing. So all the boys really came together well.
Yeah, and that's something as well that I feel with City Kickboxing success, and obviously Huge does get a lot of coverage, but Huge is one of the most phenomenal human beings I've ever met. I think most people who meet him will agree with that testament, but...
Except for those of us who have to tolerate him on a day-in, day-out basis. I think this is just the brand. This is brand Huge.
Yeah.
You get to know the real Huge. He's a despicable man.
Yeah, not waking everyone up at 7 with his godly screams every morning. But Mike, can you tell us about the rest of the coaching staff that's at CKB? Because you guys have been together for years and years and years. Can you talk us through to the coaches that are there?
Yeah, sure. Well, I guess someone who's not often in the public eye, you know, particularly around the MMA, is Doug Viney. And I met Doug when he was an 18-year-old, came into the gym, Lola Hamuli's gym, Balmoral Liga. And Doug went on to do some remarkable things. You know, he got selected for the Olympics. He won the Oceania Boxing Champs, I think in less than 9 fights, and that's including his kickboxing fights. You know, he had great talent there. He went to the Olympics. He fought an American first up in the first round. He got put out in that round, but, you know, you're talking about, you know, he was facing a guy who had about 200 fights. He won K1 New Zealand after 9 fights, 9 amateur kickboxing fights, not professional, amateur. You know, so he was thrust into the world of serious heavyweight action before he'd even had a full extent of an amateur career. So, you know, so his achievements, and he went on from there. He won K1 Las Vegas as an alternate. So he got called into the Vegas tournament. He was there as a reserve fighter, and then he came in and he won it. You know, he got into the final 16 in the world, was a hair's breadth away from, making the final 8 in the Grand Prix. I mean, that's huge for a kid who had very, very little experience at the time. You know, and his punching power and his speed were really, really remarkable. And he was a very, very small heavyweight relative to the other guys he was competing against. So, you know, he's also, I guess, Jim Sheriff, as in, he's always got his six shooter close to his hip. Anyone who misbehaves, they have to, you know, they'll get shot in the feet and have to dance. So, you know, Doug's a you know, a critical part of that. And you can see now with the work he's doing with the boxers in the gym, two top 10 world heavyweights, two top 15 guys in the world heavyweight wise, Junior Farah, obviously, Hemi Ahio, kind of a Helus now in the team. There's a few of the other boys from Tahiti. There's a really, really tight and successful boxing team there. And Doug's leading that as well as working on the kickboxing side of things. So, you know, he's pretty integral to the gym and has been for a really long time. So while Huge kind of, we see that, thankfully his face is obscured by his horrible beard, but we see his face often on screen. You know, Doug Viney is a really, really integral part of the gym. And of course he's a co-owner of the gym. Tristram Apikatoa, he's probably one of the best analytical minds in the world. You know, his ability to spot things and see holes in opponents and put together a game plan that will work. And now Tristram, also from Balmoral League, he came in at 173 kilos. We got him down to, or he got himself down really to about 140. He fought for the super heavyweight world title against Peter Graham. That was as an amateur. He also won the Oceania Boxing Champs. He went overseas, he trained around a whole bunch of different professional boxing gyms and based himself while he was in the US at Colin Oyama's gym. And, you know, he's just a wealth of knowledge. He also spent time over in the Redfern gym in Australia, which is obviously was Peter Graham's and also latterly Tony Mundine, Chop Mundine's gym, you know, where he trains. So, again, you know, huge heritage there. I'd also add that in that Redfern gym, there was also Alex Tui, who was Australia's first legitimate world kickboxing champ because he knocked out Cash Gill back in the 90s. And Alex Tui, who is Lola Haimuli's cousin and Twister's uncle, Tristram's uncle, also coming out of New Zealand as well. So, you know, there's such a rich heritage. It's just a who's who. Wrestling coaches, and we've got a couple there. We've got Andre Paulette, who's now a Kiwi citizen, much to the jealousy of Frank Hickman, who we'd never accept in New Zealand. Dirty, filthy Yank. You know, and Andre's, you know, he's competed internationally as a wrestler. He's got a huge cabinet full of trophies and medals, and he's a pretty handy, you know, southpaw kickboxer in his own right. And he's brought his game, and he's been at CKB for 7 or 8 years now as well. And you know, people slept on us as a strikers gym for a very, very long time, and the work that he's done in preparing these guys, not just their anti-wrestling, but also their wrestling, has been massive. And then you add Frank Hickman into the mix because, of course, a few of the guys went over trained at Tiger Muay Thai, which is also very, very famous. And in a sense, it's a sister gym for us as well. So Frank came over to us really through the link with Volk and with Tiger originally. And then we kind of had to tolerate him being over there more recently, helping out Israel. And there's some great in-house competitions between Andre and Frankie when they're wrestling there to see whether it's the European or the American style of wrestling, which comes out superior. So there's a nice contrast there. And obviously Georgie Hickman gets involved from time to time as well. So, you know, there's some pretty good sort of wrestling pedigree there that's coming up to get sort of global recognition, I guess, with the quality of the way they have adapted it to MMA. Obviously there's Eugene, but we've talked far too much about Eugene over many, many years. You know, he's aiming for his 50th fight. I think he's up to 48, so he's got two to go, and about 183 kilos to lose to get back to his fight weight. But I think he might need a fight dietitian.
Some of the boys have mentioned
that. You know, Eugene, I commentated, I think, his second MMA fight some years ago when he was still a blue belt against an Australian. I can't remember who, but you know, he was a New Zealand MMA champ. He was a New Zealand multiple kickboxing champ, and little people don't really know this, but he was a law student when he walked into City Kickboxing. So he's obviously put some of that intellect towards his very methodical approach to breaking down fighters and training. And he comes from a Dutch Samoan heritage as well. So, you know, typical of New Zealand, he's like all of us, he's a bit of a mongrel, and never was a word more appropriately applied. You know, and Eugene provides in many ways leadership with the group as well. Because you have so many guys who are actually world-class coaches in their own right. So, you know, that needs glue to stick that together, and it needs a lack of ego to take on board different ideas, both in terms of the coaches who are contributing, not to be offended if something doesn't get taken on board, but also to be able to receive other ideas and grow and learn. And that's a big part of that success there. A guy who's not often mentioned is Adam Johnson, who has a degree in biochemistry from memory, and he's a jiu-jitsu coach. Everyone knows all jiu-jitsu guys are nerds, and Adam is the classic 60 kilo dripping wet nerd, but you know, he puts together a lot of our training protocols, and his advice when Eugene is ranting is just to follow the science. And again, with that mindset, that brain set, where you have guys who are very, very smart. And Hughes used to say, you know, he would turn up to an MMA fight, and across the ring there'd be guys with facial tattoos, look like they'd spent 52 years in the gym, you know, still with a bit of anabolics, leaking out of their butt cheeks. And Hughes would turn up with an accountant, a lawyer, and a banker in his corner, and he said, "Always have the smartest guys in the room," you know. Mm. And it's true, yeah, these guys obviously all fought as well, but intelligence is a big thing when it comes to fight sports, both being a fighter and being a coach. So there's a couple of other guys in there as well, Steve. Who's our timer and our corner man. He's been a staple. He's about 60 years old now, and he was originally part of Balmoral as well. Had a couple of fights, and then just he's always dedicated his life to, helping out in the corner, whether it's, you know, timing, yelling, mopping afterwards. So he's an integral part of that team. So, you know, there's Ivan Walker, who's just moved away. He was a Commonwealth super middleweight kickboxing champ. Chanel Nyumata had a bronze medal at the IFMA World Champs in Muay Thai and was a multiple New Zealand champ. These are guys just wandering around the gym who, you know, are now in their 40s, and you perhaps wouldn't realise just how good they are.
Something you just said there, Mike, I wouldn't be surprised if Eugene wouldn't even remember saying this, but he said something to me when we were in China last year that it was a bit of a aha, stuck with me moment. He said, you know, I may not be the smartest person in the world, but I'm smart enough to put myself around the people who are. And that kind of stuck. I thought, yeah, that's right. Don't get me wrong, Israel, Kai, Brad, Shane, they're all great fighters, but they're surrounded by great coaches, staff around them as well. And that's a big thing. So, Mike, how does that come to be? They're insanely talented, all the five guys, and the depth of all the other guys in the gym are insanely talented. What goes in a coaching sense when you're getting ready for a fight for these guys? What are you guys doing? How do you break down the fights? How do you get these guys ready?
Look, that's a tricky thing. I think when you go back to saying guys are talented, and I think this is one of the critical things to realize, you can have a guy who's as talented as Israel or Brad or Kai walk into the gym. You might have five or six of them walk into the gym every year, all right? You need kind of that critical catalyst moment where they come in, they have the drive and the work ethic to maximize their talents. And the intestinal fortitude to sustain hardship, You need that from a fighter. You need a coach who can understand and can relate to a particular fighter. Early on in my coaching career, and even now, you know, I have a particular style which I need to amend to different personalities, and you know, that doesn't always gel. You know, thus actually having so many different coaches, sometimes it's a case of tag in, tag out as well. You know, if you just getting frustrated by someone, he may say, "Hey, I want you to work with him for a little while," or vice versa. So that helps. You know. But at a top level, almost all great fighters will have a strong relationship with one particular coach, someone who understands them mentally, someone who they have complete trust in, and that's more of a family relationship, you know, a paternal relationship, I guess, if you like, than it is just, hey, I'm going to see coach. You know, it is a fairly deep bonded kind of relationship, and Eugene's been able to forge that with Izzy in particular, Joe Lopez with Alex Volkanovski. You know, you look at anyone, you know, what Customato did with Tyson and Floyd Patterson, you know, Ali's coach, a whole lot of you know, great pairings, if you like, and that's critical, and that's a synergy of where the parts are greater, the parts or some of the parts is greater than the individual parts, if you like. That's a long way of getting back to your original question, which is, you know, how do you prepare them for a fight? Obviously, you need a bit of tape. You put heads together. You work out a strategy. The baseline stuff that is essential is they do the work, right? And that means there's a lot of science in that, whether it's your food preparation, what are you putting into your body? How do you maximize that to keep yourself at optimal performance? If you're weight cutting, as you know, you have to be also not losing too much energy, but also losing weight. And it's hard to be disciplined when you're bloody hungry after a fight. Here's a story. Supercharged Vimar, Jason Supercharged Vimar was super. He was a former Commonwealth champ. He was a world champion out of Balmoral Liga. And he was supposed to be cutting to super middleweight from light heavy. And he was like, he's following his diet. He was wearing his sweatsuit. He just couldn't lose weight. You know, he just wasn't dropping the extra 2 or 3 kilos. And bearing in mind, this is a guy with a technology degree, so he's smart. And we couldn't work it out. Supercharged, why are you still heavy? Why aren't you losing weight? He's going, I don't know. And then he goes, at the end of training one day, he goes, all right, off to get some ice cream. And we went, what? And he said, oh, I've been wearing this thermal suit, so every day after training, I go and get a liter of ice cream on the way home to cool me down. So, yeah, suffice to say, he could have done with a dietitian. that wasn't going to cool him down. But you know, it's follow the science. Doing dumb things like that because you're tired, because you think you're training really hard and the weight will come off. And then you put science to your training regime, your periodization of your programs, how you're keeping yourself between fights, what you do in a camp, you know, whether you're doing lactic capacity, alactic capacity, you know, cardiovascular work. You know, rest and recovery work, explosive work, all those things need to be integrated in a way that, again, has you at an optimal level. And that's not just in the gym, but it is making sure you're doing enough stuff outside the gym in terms of your weight work and balancing it with enough sport-specific stuff that, you know, you're not coming in as fit as possible, but you don't have enough sport-specific work. And then, obviously, it's the team, it's the sparring, it's putting fighters in positions where their camp is essentially harder than a fight. And there's a lot of different ways of doing that, some of which is kind of patent and technology, if you like. But, you know, everyone will have a shark tank. Most or the people have a version of a shark tank where you're in against multiple opponents. Most people are having a version of a spider where, you know, or a fight gone bad, you know, where it's just the worst possible situation that mentally you're rehearsing or dress rehearsing getting out of that. you know, and doing that work. And then obviously the coaches, video, watching a lot of tape, discussing, coming up with a plan, and being quite specific about what you're doing as a plan. I mean, we all know a million techniques, but in actual fact, you need to focus on what's going to work in this particular fight. You know, some fighters might have holes in their game, so you might have to not just work on correcting that hole, but working on making sure they're not in a position that exposes that hole. And really, you look for holes in your opponent's game and to put them in a position that exposes the holes in their game. And yeah, that's a long-winded way of saying it's a very, very complex process, built on a foundation of extremely hard work.
Hey guys, quick interruption of the podcast so I can mention a project that I've put far too much of my time into over the last year, TrainAid. Let's keep this brief though. What is TrainAid? It's a line of only a handful of lifestyle and performance supps that I use with all of my clients from the everyday person to UFC world champions. Who is it for? Well, that's the thing. They may not be for everyone, and we're not trying to pretend like they are. To decide if it is right for you, what we have done is created algorithms that, based on short questionnaires, will tell you 1, if the supplement is appropriate for you, and 2, how much of it you should take and when. When is it happening? Our first product, TrainAid Hydration Solution, is being released at the end of this year, so head to www.trainaid.com to stay in the loop. That's TRAINADE.com. All right, back to the podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's fascinating, right? And it's, I think unless you're involved in some capacity in that, you don't appreciate just how much goes in, especially from you guys, from the coaching staff. It's not like you guys are just rocking up to the gym and it's like, okay, I'll hold pads, I'll do this. There's so much that goes into it, especially even the game planning. I want to talk about, you mentioned Lolo there a couple of times in the history, and I don't think you gave yourself enough credit when you're talking about the other coaches. You are a former world champion kickboxer yourself. So you've obviously had a lot of influences growing up and in your training and coming up. Let's talk about the rich history of combat sports in New Zealand, because it's a fascinating and phenomenal how that came to be and how all that history has influenced it.
So I will do that, but I'll also talk about some of the guys who have a strong history in Australia, and some of the guys have been groundbreaking there, partly because I want to have a dig at all you Aussies for stealing our pavlova and farlap, but partly because, you know, that heritage, you know, crosses. Just let it be known that Peter Graham is New Zealand born. Nathan Carnage Corbett is also New Zealand born. Mark Hunt is New Zealand born. Jamie Tahuna is New Zealand born. Dylan is New Zealand born. Michael Schiavello, one of the best commentators in the world right now, got his start in New Zealand commentating K1, yeah, alongside me. So there's a lot of trans-Tasman knowledge, I guess is what I'm saying, as much as I'm, you know, sticking the shiv into the Aussie ribs. But, you know, and that has grown, and it's been a groundswell over time. And I guess in saying that, I'm also saying, you know, like, unless we're fighting each other, the Anzacs will always have each other's back. And I think that's key to get across. In terms of history in New Zealand, I mean, if you can go to a particular focal point, and I think there's a couple. One is the guy who's widely considered the founder of kickboxing in New Zealand, and that's Sifu Philip Lam. He started City Li Ga, and Li Ga, of course, is Kung Fu. Now, Philip Lam was known as Ghost Fist because he held the record for the largest number of punches thrown. I think it was within a second, like so many punches. He's very, very quick with those kind of special Chinese Kung Fu Dim Mak death touch punches. You know, so in his younger day, he was well renowned. Now, he started Muay Thai. He got fighters from Thailand to come over here and train. There were guys like Pa Thai, John Bing, Kiyosot. These were guys who were Thai champions. Fanta Atapong, who was, you know, Lumpini champion. So he brought them to New Zealand, and that's where, I guess, Muay Thai first got its hold. And out of City Li Ga, there came fighters who are now great coaches. Lola Hamuli, obviously, he's very well known. He was the trainer of Ray Sefo, Jason Suddy, Jason Bimar, Doug Viney, myself, Eugene. With that list, Twister, the list goes on and on and on. He also trained the Tongan boxing team. He's spent time with David Tour and Shane Cameron. He's a remarkable coach. And more recently, he spent time in Mark Hunt's corner, working in striking as well. But there's also other guys that have come out of there. Wayne Vainga, Lolo's cousin, is now one of the top trainers down in Christchurch. There were several Hamulis, Albert Hamuli, Tom Hamuli, all came out of City League R. And City League R is still going in New Zealand under the auspices of Tony Angelov. And he's running City League R. And, you know, City Kickboxing and Balmoral League R, we're all linked by our lineage. From there, Lolo went out on his own. He went to Telford Ave, and Telford Ave was a small room under a church, and Lolo couldn't find a place to start his gym. So he was talking to his pastor or his preacher about it, and he said, "Oh, you know, we've got a room that's full of stuff under the stairs." And so they went and cleared out this room, and they found it had already a little boxing ring in it, a tiny little boxing ring. It was like a nightmare when you had Ray Sefor chasing you around. There was nowhere to hide. You know, and that gym, on some nights, you would have 20 national and international champions sparring. You know, Ray Sefor, Jason Vamoa, Jason Suddy, Doug Viney, myself, Tristram, Eugene. There are other guys, Philemu Asan, Billy Scanlon, Jacob Ferrani, Dyson Carusa, Jojo Ancagias, who was the New Zealand's first world champion, who's of Filipino descent. You know, the Misic brothers. I could go on and on and on. Misic brothers are actually with Lee Gar, but they came into spar. And there were at least two, possibly three generations of champions coming out of Balmoral Lee Gar. And you should have bought a ticket to watch sparring. That's all I can say. You know, and it was a remarkable gym with a remarkable heritage. And one of the things that characterized that was the spirit and the family values of the gym, and the inclusiveness and leadership from Lowell. But he also had other coaches in there as well. You know, Peter Flynn was one of the original boxing coaches in there. Steve was involved in there, and Tojo Dixon, who is not a well-known name, but he used to hold Lolo's pads, and he never used a belly pad, he just used his own belly. And if you knew Lolo was one of the hardest kickers, you know, you would ever come across. Even now, I wouldn't like to get clipped by his shins, because he's got you know, really, really hard kicks. So that's where it started, right? And it's not where it started, but that's where this groundswell started. From there, you've had guys like Jason Suddy. He has started his own gym, Elite Thai Kickboxing, and now runs, you know, the King in the Ring promotion. Greg Nesbitt, who is one of our top pad holders, he runs his own gym. City Kickboxing, obviously stemmed from there, originally started by Dwayne Marshall, and then Eugene and Doug bought that. Obviously, I'm involved there. Tristram's involved there. Tristram's got his own gym in Mangere as well. One of the key things there is we didn't just learn how to fight, as we learned how to break down and understand the science of fighting. And we also developed, I guess, if you like, a brothership or a togetherness. And for me, I've been there, well, I'm 49 now, and I met Doug when he was 18, so you do the maths on that. Tristram not long after. So we've spent 30 odd years together, you know, loving and hating each other as you do, like a family does. And, you know, so that's collectiveness, that connectedness is what's actually enable or what's enabled City Kickboxing to grow. You know, as we've kind of stayed together and stayed in that collective as opposed to an individual environment, which would be very easy to do. So that's a richness of that heritage there. I'll add in a couple of other elements, which is Mark Hunt. He was discovered, and I've forgotten his original trainer. Oh God, it'll come to me later. But Mark Hunt was discovered beating up guys on the side of the street before he'd had a fight. You know, if you read Mark's book, you'll see him, you know, saying literally he fought a few weeks later. Now, Mark Hunt used to be an easy beat. He used to have tremendous power, but he was not fit and he'd just follow you around the ring and you kept punching him in the face, right? And there were a number of guys, including Ronnie Cefo, who fought and beat Mark on points. And then he decided to get himself fit. And next minute, you know, he's winning K1 Oceania. He did that on two occasions. He gets into that tremendous fight that I was ringside for with Ray Cefo, where it was, you know, Ray won the fight, but his eye was closed. He couldn't continue. And then Mark went on and he fought, I think it was Adam Watt, knocked out Adam Watt and got into the Grand Prix. And then at this stage, Michael Chiavello and I were working together and we were there commentating ringside when he stopped Labana with that 13-punch combination. And that was a rematch too with Labana. They'd fought before. You know, and so Michael Chiavello has a massive part of New Zealand heritage. Because he's been there for some of those seminal moments. So, you know, Mark Hunt is a story in himself, and he's been involved with Lolo and Balmoral, and unfortunately me from time to time, and I've had to get punched in the head by him, you know, before he went to Australia. So, you know, rich heritage there. And one other element is from the Bob Jones Corporation, who started in Australia, and they were really seminal in both bringing kickboxing and MMA to Australia and to a lesser extent New Zealand. But that spawned my original coaches before I went to Balmoral. I just got in my car one day with a big barrel of big bottles of water because the radiator keep on leaking. And about every 20 Ks, I'd fill it up, drove to Auckland. So that's a 6-hour trip, by the way. Slept on a floor and decided I was going to do varsity extramurally and live in Auckland to train in Balmoral. Different story, but I originally started in a Zendo Kai gym. Now, that Zendo Kai heritage spawned the likes of Tony Renata, who Lolo actually originally fought. It spawned coaches like Paul Jeffries, who coached me, and Charlie Chadwick, who coached me in Whanganui before I went up to Balmoral. And also, if you have a look at Paul Fifield, who was Sam Greco's original trainer, comes from Zendo Kai. So I know we're kind of, this is a long and winding path, but it's very interlinked. So we've got to acknowledge those things. Hiroa Tarangi, who I fought twice, was also out of Zendo Kai. Ivan Walker, he was also trained out of Zendo Kai, ended up in Balmoral. You know, so yes, everything came through Philip Lam in terms of that particular heritage, but there was also this influence that came over from the Bob Jones Corporation from Australia as well, which is still pretty strong in New Zealand kickboxing.
Yeah, and it's absolutely phenomenal, hey. And I wanna ask you, Mike, because I've heard you talk about this a lot, but I want to ask you, how do you feel the acceptance and the almost the embracing of combat sports in New Zealand and Australia, how it's progressed? And I want to ask you about how big of a moment was it at the Halbergs when you guys finally got that bit of recognition? Because I know you were a big advocate and you've always been a big advocate for getting New Zealand, Australia, get everyone to embrace it as a sport.
It was bittersweet, I've got to be honest, because in my mind, and yes, I'm biased, but I'm also a sports journalist who's been around for a long time. It was great because I've been in a newsroom where they wouldn't run a Joseph Parker fight or a Ray Cefo story from over the weekend because there was some third 15 junior game on in bumfluff nowhere, where an All Blacks ex-wife's niece's auntie farted, and they wanted to do that story, you know. And that goes for a lot of other minority sports. We're a very colonial and very traditional country when it comes to that. And, you know, so for that reason, it was fantastic. But the barriers are still requiring breaking down. That year, Maureen Tauroa, who is a magnificent coach, won the Coach of the Year, should have gone to Eugene. You know, just on the sheer global scale of the sport he was involved in it and what he'd achieved without funding. Nolan did a magnificent job, and I know it's subjective, but in my opinion, had things been on an equal footing, Eugene would have got Coach of the Year and probably should have had the Supreme Award. Look, the Netballers won the Supreme Award for winning, you know, the Netballs World Champs. And, you know, I'm sorry, but, you know, Jamaica, Australia, they're pretty useless anyway. You know, England, Barbados, you know, Cook Islands. Come on, guys. You know, on a global scale, and I know things are measured on more than a global scale, but on a global scale, Israel's achievement of being the undisputed champion of the world, surpassing what Joseph Parker did and winning the WBO world title, should have been recognised. So, yes, I'm biased. No, I don't hate netball. In actual fact, I think the women did a magnificent job, and Noldeen Tauroa is someone who could offer a lot to any sport she coached. I just don't think that it's a level playing field. So, yeah, look, it was great to be recognised, but let's be fair. Israel put them in a position, well, not Israel, Eugene and Israel and the team put them in a position where they couldn't argue otherwise. There was no one else within Kiwi in Sportsman of the Year. Motor racing didn't quite make it there. Kane Williamson with his cricket, I think he was second in the in the rankings in terms of test batsmen. A couple of others that, you know, look, great athletes, but had the All Blacks won that year, had the All Blacks even won, you know, even won a Tri Nations, they probably would have got in, you know. And yet, on a scale of things, it wouldn't have stacked up. So it was an emotional moment to be there, and it was great that guys like Tony Robb, Lolo, Tojo, obviously Huge, and Israel, were recognised, and that was great. But we've got a long way to go. We're in the mainstream, but we're kind of like the dirty cousin with a shiny gold watch and a Maserati. Who are like, oh yeah, okay, well, we'll let him come because we all the other guys seem to like him. We don't really, but we'll let him sit at the table. And and that's a frustration. Particularly given the standards that we hold ourselves to as athletes in terms of our behaviour out in the public arena, and having, because my sport isn't well paid and I needed to have three jobs to compete as a professional, having worked on any number of pub doors over years, watching the despicable behaviour of some of our rugby players, some of our so-called role model athletes, still makes me feel a little bitter in that there's this double standard. And I feel the same about, guys who are in exports, you know, who don't get recognition. Guys who achieve, I mean, let's face it, in New Zealand, you look at Stephen Adams, he's got to be one of the, not only is one of the most well-paid athletes, but he's got to be one of the most globally recognised athletes. He probably gets a little bit more cred than Israel does, because Israel's more outspoken. But by the way, Stephen Adams, a real fan of combat sports. Well, Scott Dixon, what he achieved in the Indy series in Indianapolis. Those guys have really, and that's motorsports, which is entrenched in New Zealand. They don't get the same recognition that rugby, cricket, netball, and to a lesser extent, league do. And that's really what, as a coach and an advocate, I want to see more recognition of. We live in a fishbowl that's like this. We begrudgingly allow someone to come into that fishbowl if they're so big that they've got a compelling case. But I think that's where our conservatism doesn't help us. We've got tremendous athletes across a range of sports that we should recognise.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's so true. Hey, and you talk to so many people. I get it all the time. Like I choose to work with fighters and I'm always faced with the same question. Oh, aren't they so aggressive? Why do you choose? It's like, no, like these are the most respectful, the most kind people that you'll ever come across. Don't get me wrong. They don't have to be, and they've got a very good switch and they can flick it off, but you'll never meet better people that are more respectful. Obviously, Israel, Dan, Brad, Kai, Shane, they're all doing great things. What do you see in the next few years for City Kickboxing? I know you've got not only just the five guys who are in the UFC, you've got guys like Carlos, Bloods, Jenna, BJ, Junior, Hemi. You've got all these other guys. You've got a gym full of to-be superstars. Everyone there has an insane work ethic, insane amount of talent, great coaching staff. What do you see happening with City Kickboxing over the next few years?
Look, we will have to continue to stay ahead of the game. You know, we are a gym of world-class strikers. You know, that has been hitherto unknown. But anyone who's smart will start watching what we do, have a look at what our strengths are, and they'll look at trying to, you know, find a way around it. In the way that, Khabib Nurmagomedov and his late father, they have worked out a pattern of wrestling against the cage to nullify strikers, you know, that grapple heavy ground and pound attack. That's an adaption that's been made. So as a gym, we need to continue to move forward. We've got heaps of talent and we've got a great system, but that system can't become stagnant. You can't rest on your laurels there. And you mentioned it before about coaching. Coaching doesn't end when you close up the gym. It's like teachers. You leave school, go home, have your Moro bar and your pie. The teachers are grading your papers and getting your schedule ready for the next day. Eugene is very much like that. Doug is like that. You know, I go to sleep much to the disappointment of my wife, with videos in my hand, you know, watching X fights, you know, for the 72,000th time, or watching footwork videos or trying to learn something from the greats. And that's what you've got to do. All of us, we all cross train in wrestling and jiu-jitsu, not necessarily because we're any good. In my case, I suck. But I'm trying to understand positions and understand, entrance points in for takedowns or defenses as for takedowns or reversals, those kinds of things. And that's kind of the attitude you need. That gives you longevity. So I predict more success, but also there's going to need to be adaption. And as with any gym, you kind of go through, peaks and then you'll plateau. That will possibly happen as well, but we'll always be a world-class operation, that's just where it's going to be. Hopefully we can keep ahead of the scale. A good example of what I'm talking about is what Max Holloway did in the last fight with Volk. He changed up his entire game. He went to a kickboxing style kicking game. He changed the direction he moved in. He varied his game quite substantially. And he did that in between camps. That's the kind of thing you have to do as a great coaching gym or a coaching setup. You have to be able to move forward in that way. And I think that's where Eugene does very well. We go back to, let's have the smartest guys in the room.
Yeah, absolutely. It's world-class gym. And yeah, I agree. I think Eugene is, like I said before, like you said to me, put himself around and put the guys around the smartest people to keep moving forward. Anyway, Mike, I won't hold you up any longer, but if people are listening to this and they go, holy smoke, Mike's not just a striking coach. He can actually talk and he's very smart. He can break down sports in a way that most can't, and they want to follow you. They want to get you on social. Do they want to get in contact? What's the best way for them to do that?
Oh, jeepers, I hadn't even thought about that. I'm on Instagram, Lightning Mike Engove, on Facebook, Lightning Mike Engove, and just Google me. You can probably even Google map the little dump that I live in. So yeah, pretty easy to get onto. But look, great to get on there. Thanks for the invite. Also, for those of you who are out there listening, I'm assuming you know just how good Geordie is at what he does. So if you're a fighter and you need to do a cut and you need to do it safely, Geordie's your man. So there you go, mate.
I was going to say, I'll transfer you the money now, Mike, for that shout out.
Yeah, all good, buddy. I'll be in the US and then in Abu Dhabi for this next fight. So we'll
see over there. I was gonna say maybe I'll buy you coffee in Abu Dhabi and said we'll call it even.
More of this healthy living.
That's
all
it,
right, buddy. Good to see
all
you.
All right, Mike. Thanks for that, mate.
Cheers, bud. Bye bye.
And there it is, another episode of the Fight Science Podcast. Combat sports are amidst an explosion in the Australian and New Zealand region, with City Kickboxing leading from the front. It is great to gain an appreciation of how that came to be and to acknowledge all of the people who have made it happen along the way. As you can tell, aside from being a great coach, Mike is a great storyteller, so go follow him on socials to keep up to date with him. This podcast will be available through the podcast app, iTunes, Spotify, YouTube, and you'll also be able to download it from my website, www.thefightdietitian.com/podcast. If you enjoy listening to the podcast, then be sure to head to the podcast app to give us a rating and leave us a review. Thanks for listening in, and I'll see you guys for the next episode of the Fight Science Podcast.